Hope in Hanoi, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama is in Vietnam, and he's lifted a ban on selling weapons to America's former enemy. Eyeing China, this Vietnamese-American entrepreneur is pleased.
With the additional support that potentially America hopefully provide, that will balance power, especially within this region.
Plus, global aid groups get together to try and fix the entire humanitarian system.
It simply cannot cope with the massive crises that are far more protracted and far more expensive than any agency is able to cope with on its own.
And one man's fight against Kenya's corrupt politicians.
Pigs are selfish, and our members of parliament are like pigs. If you steal a lot of money, you go into politics and you buy yourself immunity.
Those stories and more today here on The World. Good to have you with us on this Monday. I can imagine that for several generations to come, Vietnam will be symbolic of a war that becomes a quagmire, the bloodiest U.S. conflict since World War II, with an outcome that did not ring a victory. So a lot of very painful memories for many Americans. And yet President Obama is there right now trying to project a very different sort of image, that of a relationship enjoying a new level of cooperation 41 years after the fall of Saigon. And that includes Obama's decision announced today to lift the embargo on U.S. companies selling arms to Vietnam.
People that have been paying attention to this issue have seen it coming.
The World's Patrick Nguyen covers Southeast Asia from his base in Bangkok.
We just didn't think that it was going to happen so soon. I mean, it's pretty obvious that the U.S. and Vietnam are moving closer and closer together. They've been making a lot of efforts to create a bridge and a friendship between the two militaries. And it's just sort of a surprise that this came today.
How significant is it that the U.S. can now sell arms to Vietnam and Vietnam can actually buy them?
Okay, so big picture, let's keep in mind, with very few exceptions, America has an armed communist nation since World War II, and that was to help Stalin fend off the Nazis, right? So it's kind of big that we're about to arm a communist nation. In a more modern perspective, you know, we have to understand that they are driven by a common goal, and that's to thwart the rise of China, particularly China's dominance of the South China Sea.
Right. So this is as much a business deal with between Vietnam and the United States as it is kind of a geopolitical statement aimed at China.
Right. Well, you know, Vietnam thinks that what's called the South China Sea, that they have dibs on that, that they have ownership of it. China regards the entire sea as, you know, its own aquatic backyard. And the U.S. would like to make sure that China doesn't dominate this really important waterway. So when Vietnam is thinking about defending itself, and that's what Obama said that the U.S. was there to do, to help Vietnam defend itself. Well, defend itself against who? I think the answer is China.
And yet President Obama kind of went out of his way to say this was not directed at anyone. What do you think that was about?
I think Obama has to make the right diplomatic noises. You know, they don't want to exacerbate the very real tensions that are happening between the U.S. and Vietnam and between Vietnam and China. China, to its credit, didn't blow its top. A Chinese official came out and said, well, you know, the ban was based on an ideological factor stemming to the Cold War. That's over. So it does make sense that they would lift the ban. But, you know, moving down the road in the future, I think this is going to heighten tensions for sure.
Are you surprised Beijing didn't react more strongly?
I mean, to be honest, yeah, I am. Beijing puts out these state-run papers that have written really, really extreme op-eds about the U.S. coming into the South China Sea and propping up Vietnam and the Philippines to help thwart its rise. And they've referred to these countries as, you know, little mosquitoes that the U.S. is riling up, and how this is, you know, going to end tragically, and even hinted at conflict. So I'll be looking out for those op-eds in the future. But today they made very conciliatory gestures towards the U.S. and Vietnam and said, okay, we get it. No big deal.
I know Human Rights Watch is not happy about the deal. Tell us why.
Yeah, Human Rights Watch thinks that the U.S. gave Vietnam a gift with nothing in return. Human Rights Watch and other human rights groups has their eye on political prisoners in Vietnam. You know, it's still a very authoritarian state, even if it's not so much a communist state. There are lots of human rights abuses that happen in Vietnam, and they thought that the U.S. should wait until they resolve those abuses. But let's keep in mind all of the other countries, including, say, Saudi Arabia, that the U.S. arms, that do not have great human rights records either.
President Obama said each arms deal would be scrutinized carefully with human rights in mind. But I guess for Human Rights Watch and other critics, that's not enough of a check?
I don't think so. And let's get a reality check here. U.S. weapons are not going to start flooding into Vietnam. Vietnam is not going to buy, you know, some super tricked out fighter jet tomorrow. A lot of Vietnam's weaponry is based on the Soviet era. They have a lot of aging Russian weaponry. So you can't just buy U.S. gear and mix and match it with Russian gear. It just simply doesn't work that way. And the other thing is the U.S. gear, military gear, is quite expensive. And Vietnam just doesn't have a big enough defense budget at this time.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Mickey Nguyen is a Vietnamese-American entrepreneur. We've spoken with him before about his father's role in the war and Mickey's memories of it as a kid. Mickey was born in Vietnam, and he recently moved back there. And for him, this Obama visit is a big deal.
Seeing Obama here is just so extremely promising. It gives the people here another choice, right? Another hope. Besides just trading with China and at the same time resenting many of the things that China has done, especially for most of these days that we hear in the news with the chemical spill in the central region killing off a lot of fish. And so with Obama coming, the presence of U.S., it's very optimistic, and the hope of this country just got lifted with him flying in yesterday.
You've got kind of a special perspective on this since you straddle both sides of the fence as a Vietnamese and an American. This is the third president to visit Vietnam since the end of the war. For you, what does Obama's trip signify?
Continued strengthening of the relationship. Every time that a president from America, the U.S., visits this country, it just further strengthens the relation between both sides.
I'm curious to know how you feel about Obama's decision to lift the ban of weapon sales in Vietnam. He said it was the last vestige of the Cold War to go. But in some respects, the ban's been lifted partly as a response to China's activity in the South China Sea. What do you think about all that?
It's critical that this country here maintain a balance of power. China has been creeping closer and closer in terms of the sensitive South China Seas and the oil and the fishing activities out there. And so with the additional support that potentially America hopefully provide, that will balance the power, especially within this region. We've seen Vietnam itself as a country been invaded by for hundreds of years from the French and the Chinese and the Japanese and other countries. And I don't think this is any different in terms of holding our ground, holding our country here.
So the last time you were with us on the world, Mickey, you shared this incredible dramatic story of how your father escaped from Vietnam with you, your sister, and your mom in a Chinook helicopter. Your dad died, sadly, a few years ago, but what do you think he would be thinking of this trip and the lifted embargo?
He still has a lot of family here, aunts and uncles, myself, aunts and uncles, and I've got a lot of cousins here. And so for the citizens that are of this country, I think my dad would like to see a little bit more strengthening of this country to see that his family members are protected here from any sort of insurgence that China may, contemplate.
Mm. Mickey, I'm curious, you've only been back a few months in Vietnam. Is there anything that you've recognized from when you were a boy?
A lot of change. Every time I come back, once a year or twice a year, just new buildings cropping up. There's a lot of hope and optimism. There's opportunities and entrepreneurship in this country that, if you have a big dream, then you can come back here and pursue it.
As a businessman, does the human rights issue concern you?
Any human rights in any country, any part of the world concerns me. I grew up in America enjoying the freedom of religion, freedom of education, and the freedom to speak my mind in public, and would like to see that same freedom for this country as well. I think any healthy country should allow a healthy means for its people to voice its thoughts and its opinions.
Mickey Nguyen, Vietnamese-American entrepreneur currently based in Vietnam. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. Appreciate the time.
Now to a country where the economy is imploding. I'm talking about Venezuela. Its vast oil wealth once helped the late President Hugo Chavez keep voters happy, but things turned sour after oil prices plummeted. Now the current leader, President Nicolas Maduro, is taking another page from the Chavez playbook and blaming the country's economic woes on a foreign conspiracy led by Washington. We don't hear a lot of reporting from inside Venezuela, but my BBC colleague Guerra Davis traveled to Caracas recently and sent this report.
Que viva la Fuerza Armada Nacional Bolivariana. Que viva el pueblo de Venezuela. Venezuela's combative president Nicolas Maduro at the culmination of a military exercise this weekend called Operation Independence. Evoking heroes from the country's past, especially his predecessor Hugo Chavez, President Maduro paints a picture of a utopia under the very real threat of invasion from its imperialist enemies. But it's not a vision that many other Venezuelans see. Life here can be a matter of life and death. Hospitals like this one I visited in the city of Maracay are chronically under-resourced. Patients die from a lack of basic drugs. They have to buy medicines and surgical equipment before they can have an operation. Senior trauma surgeon Juan Carlos Davos says the system is broken.
In Venezuela, la salud es gratuita. Eso es falso.
It is not true that healthcare is free in Venezuela. Here, those who can't afford to buy their medical supplies themselves are simply dying. That is the truth.
Raw materials now, we want to keep our jobs. That's the cry from workers at this Empresas Polar plant just to the west of Caracas. Empresas Polar is the country's biggest and arguably most important private company. But it's threatened with nationalisation. The government has accused it of hoarding goods, not supplying beer, food and drinks to the vital domestic market. Workers here fear that the clash between their private company and the government might mean imminent nationalisation and occupation of their plant by soldiers. You have to admire the resilience and stoicism of Venezuelans. For the last 2 years, this has been a country of queues. People here in Caracas and in cities across the country queue for everything from food to basic medicines, toiletries and manufactured goods. The socialist government of Nicolas Maduro says this is all the fault of big business hoarding goods and even of foreign governments trying to destabilize the country's socialist revolution. The reality is perhaps that this country has been badly, chronically mismanaged with an over-dependence on oil revenues in the past that have since crashed through the floor. Either way, the real victims are the people of Caracas, these people outside the Petare shantytown, who are queuing for hours outside these supermarkets, not even knowing what they might find inside. I have to queue every single day, says this young mother, who can't hold down a job because she has to spend so much time searching for basics. At the minute, there seems to be very little on the shelves, she says. Not most of the food we need, and certainly not nappies for the baby. A team of international mediators has been in Caracas trying to get the two sides around the table, the opposition-led Congress and the socialist government of Nicolas Maduro. The rhetoric in Caracas has been dire, both sides invoking the possibility of military intervention. And that's why some sort of deal, some sort of formal negotiation is critical. Venezuela, which should be one of Latin America's wealthiest and most stable nations, is today quite the opposite.
The BBC's Wera Davis in Caracas. A quick peek now at a story we'll have later in the show. Next month, Swiss voters will consider this, whether each and every citizen should get $2,600 a month.
If you make no money, you just have no income, you're a citizen of Switzerland, you would get a check, no questions asked, for $2,600 a month.
It's called a basic guaranteed income, and Switzerland's not the first place to consider it. That story's coming up a little later here on The World. He did not win, but the candidate for the far-right Freedom Party in Austria's presidential election came very, very close. As of last night, the populist Freedom Party candidate was in the lead, barely. But since then, about 700,000 mail-in ballots have been counted, and it was the independent Green Party that came from behind and took the win. The Freedom Party candidate, Norbert Hofer, has accepted defeat. Melanie Sully is watching the numbers closely. She's head of Go Governance. That's an independent institute based in Vienna to promote democratic governance. So this was a close one, Melanie. What is your reaction?
Well, it was a very exciting election night, as you probably gathered. And there's a lot of relief, obviously, on one side and some disappointment on the other. The country is basically split into two kinds of camps, if you like. because these two candidates were so different. They had such a different conception of what the office of federal president would be, and also very, very different political views. So now the job is to try to actually get the country together, to unite, to heal, and to find some way in which both sides then can come together.
So how close did Norbert Hofer come to actually winning this?
I think there's about 30,000 votes difference between the two. That's in an electorate of about 6.5 million. So not that many, really.
So that means the concerns that Hofer raised during his campaign are still there because a lot of people voted for him. How does Hofer talk about refugees?
Well, he says basically, you know, we will respect international law and this kind of thing. We won't turn anybody away who's in need. But there are so many people that came last year across the borders without any documentation, without registration, and people just didn't know who they were, where they came from. And in fact, not even knew whether they were genuine refugees. And Hofer was saying basically the external borders of the EU should be defended. Otherwise, Austria will have to defend its own borders and put up some kind of barrier.
So how would you distinguish the winner of this election, Alexander Van der Bellen, the Green Party leader and independent candidate? Would you say he and they are pro-refugee?
Well, yes. I mean, they were very open to refugees coming last year and very concerned that people should not be divided amongst themselves and that conflict could be kept to a minimum. And that obviously what you have to do is think about how to integrate people. You know, you can obviously invite people into your home, but you really have to make efforts to tell them exactly what they can do, what they can't do, and to prepare them for a life by giving them German courses or whatever, and making sure they will have some perspectives and outlook, and that they will be well integrated into the community. And I think that is easier in the towns, basically, than in some of the more rural areas.
What do you think the Austrian lesson is for the American presidential campaigns? And should the Democratic Party here be concerned?
Well, I think the message is not just for the US, but also other countries in Europe. And remember, we got a so-called Brexit referendum coming up in the UK, is that you really have to listen to the concerns of ordinary people. People voted for Hofer because they thought he was listening to them, not just talk all the time, but actually do something. And listening is also part of politics. Find out what their real concerns are and actually offer something positive. So without being populist, and that's really difficult, but nevertheless, try to make sure that people are on board and with you rather than racing ahead and just hoping they'll trail along.
Melanie Sully heads Go Governance. That's an independent institute based in Vienna to promote democratic governance. Thanks for your time, Melanie.
Okay, thank you.
We turn now to Brazil, where the Greens are protesting rather than celebrating. Brazil's acting president, Michel Temer, is from a more conservative party than his suspended predecessor, Dilma Rousseff. She's facing impeachment for financial misconduct. And Green activists in Brazil are worried about what Temer's rightward shift might mean as the legislature considers major changes to environmental rules. I asked the world's Brazil correspondent, Will Carlos, to explain.
There are micro worries and there are macro worries. So on the macro side, it's the general idea that we have a rightward shift to a more conservative government at a time of political and economic crisis in Brazil. And in part, that economic crisis is being blamed on over-restrictive protections of the environment and things like that. So the fear is that these guys will sort of seek to boost the economy, seek to get things going again by rolling back regulations. That's kind of the macro side. And then on the micro side, you have things like this constitutional amendment that they're trying to push that would literally just allow the promoter of a big project to sort of file an environmental impact report and then get on with it and start their project, as opposed to the long, arduous system they have now, which has some checks and balances to make sure that large parts of the rainforest aren't being chopped down, for example.
Right. And are those activists concerned that the people who will be affected are the people who live in the rainforest or pretty much everybody, rural, urban, across Brazil?
They are indeed, Marco. So here's a guy called Christian Poirier from Amazon Watch, who I spoke to a couple of days ago.
Temer's cabinet now is stacked with people who are anti-indigenous, who support measures which would essentially end demarcations of indigenous territories, and not only end these demarcations, but allow for large projects to be built inside of indigenous territories.
So, Will, former President Dilma Rousseff hasn't been officially impeached yet. It's unclear how long Michel Temer will be president. How real do you think those concerns are from environmentalists?
Well, I feel like I write a lot of stories in Brazil, which are sort of, here is this nasty, scary bill that's coming down the line, but how many of them actually become law? And so I put that question to a few people last week, and what they told me was, look, this is very real. I mean, some of these laws are in their very final stages. They've already passed through all the committees and such that they need to go through, and now they're really just kind of waiting on a vote of Congress and the president's seal. President Dilma Rousseff, not the sort of best environmental champion out there, but she had pledged to veto some of these laws. She's now gone, and Temer shows all signs that he will sort of sign on to them. So the environmentalists are very worried. They see this as a very imminent threat, and they say, you know, it's not crying wolf. We've got to be really careful.
Yeah, so the environmentalists are not fans of Michel Temer. There were also protests against Temer this weekend when he apparently temporarily shut down the Ministry of Culture. Artists and actors infuriated by that. Who likes Michel Temer right now?
I imagine his wife likes him. I mean, I can't think of too many other people, but I mean, he's a very, very deeply unpopular figure. So, I mean, he's got a lot to prove. He hasn't really had a good couple of weeks either. So he's got to get cracking at making friends and influencing people.
Will, is there something I'm not getting about politics in Brazil? If Temer used to be Dilma Rousseff's vice president, how come he seems to be changing all sorts of things she set in motion?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And something that people outside of Brazil perhaps don't understand is that the way that presidents are elected in Brazil is very different. What tends to happen here is that you'll have a sort of a coalition, a cobbling together of several different parties. Unlike in the States, where it's sort of one party against the other, here it's a coalition and they sort of form teams. And one of the big things you do to get one of the minor parties on board is to offer things like a vice presidentship. But in this case, obviously, it sort of backfired on Dilma, and somebody who used to be sort of a compatriot of hers is now a mortal enemy.
Will Carlos, the World's reporter in Rio de Janeiro. Thanks as always, Will.
Thank you.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tired of the welfare state? Well, you could try this.
Some people say, look, there's a lot of bloat when it comes to welfare and food stamps. Get rid of all that stuff. Just give people $10,000, $12,000 a year.
It's called a guaranteed basic income, and Switzerland might be about to sign off on the idea. That's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Help is a simple word, but providing help to the 125 million people around the globe who need it is not a simple act. That number includes some 60 million refugees or internally displaced people. Bottom line, according to the United Nations, the world currently faces the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. So where do you start to fix the problem? That's what representatives from 175 countries are trying to figure out at the world's first humanitarian summit in Istanbul. My BBC colleague Lise Doucette is there.
In terms of the humanitarian summit itself, those who are backing it, including the main man organizing it, Stephen O'Brien, who's the UN's humanitarian chief, he points out that this is the first time in 70 years in the whole history of the United Nations that they have gathered for this kind of a summit to take a long, hard look at a humanitarian system which, quite frankly, is broke financially and is breaking down. It simply cannot cope with the massive crises that are far more protracted and far more expensive than any agency is able to cope with on its own. So today they called for a grand bargain, a different way for all of the actors working in these humanitarian crises to work together.
Why is the U.S. not there? And how are these important kind of wealthy countries who are not present in Istanbul, what's that doing to a sense of solidarity that the wealthy countries could actually help out here?
Well, none of the five permanent members of the Security Council, Russia, China, the U.S., France, and Britain, they don't have any high-level representation here. The backers of this summit will say, well, this is an aid conference. They've sent their aid chiefs. But some people have said, well, you know, this is as important an issue as the climate change summit. And that was a proper summit, which had world leaders there. And to say for everyone to hear that they were committed to tackling, in that case, climate change. So the big question is, why didn't world leaders clear their diary for this? Well, maybe they felt it wasn't the right time to do it. Some people here are already saying, well, the real decisions will be taken in September when President Obama convenes a migration summit at the United Nations.
I mean, there are charities as well who've responded kind of negatively to this summit. Doctors Without Borders pulled out, saying that the summit is a fig leaf to hide international failures. Oxfam has called it just an expensive talking shop. Do they have a point?
Well, Médecins Sans Frontières did give pause for thought to some other aid agencies who decided not to come. There are absences of some groups because, A, they thought Médecins Sans Frontières had a good point. They didn't want to come, to use the Oxfam word, a talking shop. Some were concerned about security. There have been attacks by the so-called Islamic State. And they also felt that Istanbul, Turkey, right now, is not the right venue to be bringing in all the great and the good. But I've asked other aid agencies here, including the International Committee of the Red Cross, and they say, no, it is important to be here. It is important to show up. It is important to try to make this system work. If we don't meet among all these various actors, and someone put it this way to me, that anyone who's anyone in the aid community, except for the exceptions we mentioned, they are all here because they absolutely recognize that they are being overwhelmed by humanitarian crises in the Middle East, in Africa, and in Asia, and that simply the needs of the international community are far outstripping the resources that the international community has to deal with them.
In essence, are all these countries in Istanbul there essentially to say that the scale of humanitarian crises around the world have just gotten too much for them to deal with?
Well, there is that, but there are some interesting suggestions. For example, I spoke to the head of the Western Union, and many of your listeners will know it's the big, one of the Fortune 500 companies which moves money around the world. Mm-hmm. The head of it is very much involved in fundraising for Syria, very much involved in getting other members of the private sector to try to make this work so that you don't just look to the traditional aid agencies to try to solve these crises. You look to the credit card companies to find new ways of getting resources to refugees. You look at the private sector to raise money for them, to give jobs to Syrian refugees. You have the founder of Chobani Yogurt, and he's hiring Syrian refugees in his factories. I think they have a point in that it is time to think outside the box. And at the end of the day, what is really important is that the people who are getting this aid, they're not just victims. They don't want to be dependent. You have to find ways to give them livelihoods, to get their children in schools, to give families jobs, to give them a sense for the future, because these are crises that they're not going to end tomorrow or next week or next year, or maybe not even in the next decade or more. So you have to find a way to give people decent lives and livelihoods. And we don't now have the approaches to make that happen.
My BBC colleague Lise Doucette at the first conference on humanitarian aid in Istanbul. When you're talking humanitarian aid, you're dealing first with life essentials, food, water, clothing, and shelter for the most part. Getting a living wage hopefully comes later. But a living wage is by no means guaranteed in most countries, including here in the U.S., and including Switzerland. True, you don't associate poverty with a super-rich nation like Switzerland, but the Swiss do have a poverty problem. And one solution they're kicking around is a guaranteed basic income for Swiss citizens. My WGBH colleague Kara Miller has been doing some reporting on this. She hosts the public radio program Innovation Hub.
So you can think of this in some ways as Social Security, but for everyone, not just for people over 65. The Swiss are voting on June 5th on the idea of guaranteeing everybody, every adult, $2,600 a month. Actually, if you're a child, you are guaranteed $650 a month. So here's how it would work. If you make no money, you just have no income, you're a citizen of Switzerland, you would get a check, no questions asked, for $2,600 a month. Now, let's say you make $3,000 a month, which is obviously over that limit. The first $2,600 would just be tax-free. You wouldn't actually get a check in the mail, but you wouldn't have to pay taxes on that $2,600 because that is sort of the amount that they guarantee everybody. And they say, this is what you need to live. We're not going to impose taxes on that.
Social Security for Everyone. Are naysayers in Switzerland calling this welfare for everyone?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the argument against basic income in every country that it has been tried and will be tried in is that it's much too expensive, you know, that it'll bankrupt the country, and also that it is a disincentive to work, you know, that you're going to get a bunch of lazy people and they're all going to live on this basic income. So definitely that is the argument against.
All right, let's talk about the arguments for. Where has this been tried before and what have been the successes?
So one place it's been tried is Namibia. In 2008, there was a very small town where it was tried. Everybody in the town was given this income. It did not matter how rich or poor you were. One thing they saw was a rise in the number of kids attending school. And the other thing they saw was a decline in the number of children who were malnourished. So that was a very good outcome. Probably the biggest place this has ever been tried is between 1974 and 1979. There was a five-year experiment in a town called Dauphin in Manitoba, Canada. And they did sort of a variation on basic income where about a third of the people in town were poor enough that they literally didn't have to apply for anything. They got a check in the mail. And I talked to economist Evelyn Forget about this, who has really pored over this data of, okay, what happened in Manitoba? This is one of the biggest experiments we've ever seen of people getting quote-unquote free money. And she said one of the things that happened is you start to realize how complicated poverty is.
We're often very focused on the costs of this kind of a program without realizing the costs that poverty imposes on a society. Healthcare is a tremendously expensive undertaking. Much of it is paid for from public funds. But it's not very hard to imagine that there are a lot of other social programs where expenditures, costs, are related to poverty. The higher the poverty rate, the more we spend on special education. The higher the poverty rate, the more we spend on child and family services, on programs to offset family violence, to deal with the hardships that people face.
So one of the things they found was that hospitalizations did go down under this program. The other thing they found was that two groups of people did stop working, or at least pulled back a little bit from the workforce. One was women who had recently had children, and they essentially got longer maternity leaves because they had more money lying around. The other was teenage boys who had been dropping out of school to get a job and then help, you know, the family pay for its living. And then they decided, well, our family has more money. We're going to finish high school. Maybe we'll go on to college. So they did see people pull back from work. And those were the two groups.
So the United States has this high value on productivity, just 10 vacation days per year. Yeah. Most people get. Could this happen here in the U.S.?
It's a really interesting question. And I have to say, you know, I've talked to people about this and different people believe in it for different reasons. Some people say, look, there's a lot of bloat when it comes to welfare and food stamps. Get rid of all that stuff. Just give people $10,000, $12,000 a year. Other people say that the reason for this is because automation is going to take our jobs. We've already seen it, you know, getting rid of a lot of the middle class, and that's only going to be a bigger problem going forward. You've got to give people a kind of safety net that they can fall into so they are not destitute.
Kara Miller, the host of Innovation Hub, heard on many public radio stations. Kara, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
It would be interesting to see what a guaranteed income would do in a place like Kenya. The economy there is growing, but unemployment is high, especially among young people. Experts say one factor holding Kenya back is rampant corruption. Nick Schifrin sent us this report from Nairobi.
On the streets of Eastleigh, Nairobi, there's a saying, Kenya is the homeland of the bribe. And in this neighborhood, the victims of those bribes point their finger at one perpetrator, cars full of police. Abdullahi Mohammed is a local activist.
You see cars from all police stations in Nairobi converging here.
They refer to this neighborhood as what?
ATM machines.
As an ATM machine. Because they take so much money.
They take so much money.
Mohammed, like most of his neighbors, is ethnic Somali and Muslim. They feel like second-class citizens and are neglected.
We're walking on this street. It's pretty busy. We can see potholes in the street. The street's not that good. I mean, what are the conditions here like?
Garbage are not collected. They build half-baked roads. Year in, year out, they promise things. That happens.
And while the politicians provide promises and nothing happens, residents say the police come here not to patrol, but to get rich.
You know, you just arrest someone, you take 5,000, 3,000, 2,000, depending on how rich the person is.
That's $20 to $50, depending on how rich the victim is. Police officers, when promised anonymity, admit they're more focused on keeping the cash than keeping the peace. We met one of them in a quiet corner of the neighborhood.
How were police officers extorting people in Eastleigh? the little amount that you are paid as salary.
He says his salary is too low for him to provide for his family. That's why he takes bribes.
Is this corruption being practiced by so many police officers in so many different areas?
Of course. It's right from the junior officer to the highermost.
It's right from the junior officer to the highermost, he says. And the problem is, when the police are for sale, criminals buy their freedom.
A criminal can come, do anything that they want, they go free. You'll pay, and you go free.
While police let criminals free, they arrest anti-corruption activists. That's 32-year-old Boniface Mwangi. In a country where activist is a dirty word, Mwangi is a fearless, relentless firebrand. He's a former journalist whose political activism is often a performance. He once covered pigs with fake blood outside parliament.
Pigs are selfish. And our members of parliament are like pigs. If you steal a lot of money, you go into politics and you buy yourself immunity.
He might be considered over the top, except what he's fighting is so outrageous and well documented. Transparency International says Kenyans living in cities pay, on average, 16 bribes a month, and 99% of those bribes are demanded by government officials, state employees, and the police. Residents here accuse police of being in the pockets of crooked politicians. In one recent notorious example, Mwangi was there during a school kids' protest. A landowner connected to the deputy president seized their playground so he could build a hotel parking lot. The police broke up the protest and protected the landowner by firing tear gas at the school kids.
So they tear gassed innocent kids who wanted to access their playground. Other countries have mafia. In Kenya, the mafia have a country.
The government and the police officially deny corruption. They promise to prosecute any officers who ask for bribes. But police spokesman Charles Owino also promises to prosecute the victims.
Any person who bribes a police officer is equally responsible. Giving money to a police officer or bribery is an offense.
But the residents of East Lee say they have to choose between giving relatively small bribes and going to jail on trumped-up charges. And the problem is, when the system of corruption is so ingrained, your fellow citizen becomes the abuser. Again, Boniface Mwangi.
They did a survey the other day about young people, and the majority are saying if they got a chance to be corrupt, they'd be corrupt. In a country of shortcuts where there are no national values, then everyone wants to become a thief.
And the thieves are out to get him. He receives death threats and often considers his mortality. He's even produced a video, which went viral, called One Day I Will Die, where he imagines his own death. A coroner opens the door and checks his cold body. And to mournful music, his wife walks through the cemetery where he's been buried.
I grew up a coward and I grew up afraid. And then I realized I was living an empty life. And when I lost that cowardice and said, you know what, I'm going to take a stand on issues. Am I afraid? Yes. Do I get afraid? Yes. Have I been threatened? Yes. Will I ever stop speaking? No. Until I'm dead. You have to do it.
For The World, Nick Schifrin, Nairobi.
Nick's reporting in Kenya, supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We keep hearing how there's a lot at stake in the presidential election this fall, like a lot more than usual. That may be why we're also hearing a lot about efforts to get out the vote this year. And in parts of the country, some people who are pushing to bring others to the ballot box can't even vote themselves. Reporter Shuka Kalantari met a group of teenagers who are doing just that in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Hello, I'm speaking with Claudia Rivera. My name is Jessica and I'm calling from Casa in Action. Casa in Action is an organization that fights for the rights of immigrants as well as...
Jessica Hernandez is in a small room with about a dozen other people at Casa Maryland in Silver Spring. They're spending their Thursday night calling Latino immigrants to get them to register to vote. But some of the volunteers, like Hernandez, can't vote themselves.
I'm like what you call an alien, but I am in the process of trying to get papers, and then I will vote to make a difference for us immigrants.
Hernandez is 19 and came here from Mexico 2 years ago. She's undocumented and is dealing with the frustration of not being able to vote by making sure others do.
I can't physically put my vote in and say, okay, I want this change. So I go around telling my friends who were born here or who do have papers and are able to vote. So I tell them, you can make a difference for us. Like, each vote is very, very important.
Hernandez says she's never been politically active before. But this election has changed that.
I'm like, no, dude, like, what if Trump wins by one vote? Like, your one vote could make a difference for somebody else.
Then there are volunteers here like Juan Carlos Espeno. He's also from Mexico and can't vote because he's only 17. But like Hernandez, that doesn't stop him from going door to door to get people to register to vote.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Bien.
¿Este está registrado para votar?
No.
Even though he's a U.S. citizen, Espeno wants other Latinos to register to protect his undocumented friends. He wants to be part of their fight.
Their fight for justice, for equal rights. Because I am 100% Latino. And those are my brothers and sisters. And I gotta help my brothers and sisters. They're family. They have to be helped.
It's apartment 3, it's apartment 5.
Espeno says he'll keep knocking on strangers' doors if that's what it takes to keep away a future president with anti-immigrant policies. And as for what he'd propose if he were president?
If I were to be president, I would pass an immigration reform. That's what I would do. I would unite families again together. Offer them jobs, make them citizens, productive citizens of the United States. Make them family. We need more unification rather than division.
There are millions of Latino citizens in the U.S. not registered to vote. Volunteers like Jessica Hernandez and Juan Carlos Espino know they'll only reach a fraction of these people. But they'll keep up their efforts, knowing that every person they get to show up at the polls might represent a vote in their favor. For the world, I'm Shuka Kalantari, Silver Spring, Maryland.
I get music from all over the globe in my mailbox. Sometimes I'll get an album from a singer in, say, Argentina, and I can start to imagine, even before I listen to the first track, what direction the music might go in. That was not the case with an album by an artist named La Yegros. Argentina is experiencing a renaissance of its own version of South American cumbia, a loping country sound that came out of the Andes. For the past 5 years or more, cumbia has been getting sampled and hip-hopped and electrified in Buenos Aires. La Yegros is part of this movement, but as she told us, that Nueva Cumbia trend is only the beginning of her musical experimentation.
My music is not based on cumbia. There is some cumbia, but other rhythms too that Argentines would recognize, like chamamé, carnavalito, or milonga.
For those not immersed in all the musical cultures of Argentina, you may not recognize all those different styles, but the sounds will move your feet, like the hook from the track Atormentada, which you've probably already heard on our show a few times.
Atormentada estoy, atormentada, atormentada estoy con tu.
Mariana Yegros took her family name and made it her brand so she can, in her words, honor her origins. Those origins are Argentina, but La Yegros now makes her home in France. It's where she and her band began to tour as artists, and it's a place that welcomes her.
I needed stability instead of planes, hotels, and buses. And I wanted to be based where we were playing a lot. It was important that the French public welcomed me. So I chose a home where I could be introspective in my downtime and where I could feel protected and less like a nomad. I'm also lucky I can travel to Argentina a lot, which helps me stay in touch with my own people and my friends. It's a luxury and I'm far from home, but I also feel at home.
And even though La Yegros stays connected with Argentina, she says there's also a counterintuitive learning curve she's found by not being in Argentina.
Bueno, creo que no solo Francia, sino cualquier lugar en donde visite.
She told me that she gets from other countries the wealth of what I don't know. I'm enriched, she says, when I meet other musicians from other countries and they have instruments we don't know in our culture. And it inspires me to create new music, new songs. For this song, Chicha Rosa, La Yegros got help from award-winning Argentine producer and multi-instrumentalist Gustavo Santaolalla. Señora chichera, deme alguito, yo le pagaré. The new album by La Yegros is out now, and it is pretty smoking. It's called Magnetismo. That is our show for this Monday. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.